Hi, you're listening to my favourite Elliott Smith song. This podcast is all about keeping Elliott Smith's legacy alive in our own very small way. And we do that by speaking to well-known fans about their favourite song of his. So hi, and in today's episode, we have musician, writer and fellow podcaster John Roderick as our guest. John was born just a year before Elliott Smith and was part of the music scene in Seattle, just as Elliott was making a name for himself in nearby Portland, first with Heat Miser and then as a solo artist. And in this interview, John talks about their time as part of similar scenes and why Elliott was able to stand out from the rest of the crowd. He also discusses what it was like seeing him play live and why he has what he calls a complicated relationship with Elliott's music. So here he is. Here's John Roderick in conversation with Elizabeth Withstanley.
My name's John Roderick. I play in a band called The Long Winters, which was a Seattle band that started in the year 2001. Before that, I was in Harvey Danger. And then in the mid-90s, I played in a band called the Western State Hurricanes, which was a Seattle band that almost released a record. But I was in Seattle during the time period of Elliott Smith's early career and was at some early shows and then, you know, followed him throughout his all-too-brief arc. Well, my favorite Elliott Smith song is the first song that I really dove into, which is Speed Trials, which was the first song on Either Or. Hearing it the first time and then had a kind of a world-altering effect on me. At the time, I'd seen Elliott Smith already twice. He played a lot in Seattle during this period. In 1997, he played a half a dozen times, and I was, at that point, someone who went to five shows a week, like indie rock and live music was my whole life. It was everything I did. I was either playing or I was going to shows. And I'd seen him, and at the show I saw at the Crocodile Cafe sometime in 97, like the audience all sat on the floor, which was a thing I'd never seen before. And he's up there with an acoustic guitar and playing very quietly. And during that period, it was post-grunge. Everybody was trying every kind of thing they could to have some sort of Pacific Northwest music that wasn't grunge. And I saw this show where he was performing so quietly, and the audience, which I felt like was a little bit younger than me, was so reverent that I was suspicious of it. I felt like, what is this? You know, what is this? I mean, it was before we even had a word for emo, but it felt emo, and it felt emo in a what struck me as a self-conscious way. So Elliott Smith just seemed like somebody on the scene in the Northwest that was doing something. And there were so many bands, right, that just sort of doing something. But then Either Or came out, and this was also a time when a record would come out and someone of your friends would rush out and buy it and really show up at your door like, you got to hear this new record, and come in and put it on. And that record went on the turntable and Speed Trials came on. And the sound of it was like the opposite of everything I was trying to do as a songwriter. Acoustic guitars. It felt like a strange amount of compression. The drums were quiet and it didn't even sound like the snare was on. I mean, it was being played with brushes, you know, and it had that kind of, the intro has this sort of drone. One guitar is just pedaling while the chords change underneath it. And it felt like an assault, almost an assault on everything that all the bands that I knew and I was trying to accomplish with music, which was to make a massive emotional impact on people, to hit them with that My Bloody Valentine wall. You know, we were all trying to hurt your feelings with our music, and not in a way where we're insulting you, but hurt your feelings by sharing how hurt our feelings were. And here was this music that was just devastating from the sound of his voice. The first time, the moment it comes in, actually before that, just in the instrumental opening, you know that it's a gut punch. It made me just suddenly evaluate my whole approach. His songs are not narrative, right? And in my own songwriting, my songs also are not narrative. And there are a lot of people that write songs that they walk you through a story. And what he's doing is creating a story by way of sense impression. Like each line is a story, and you're brought along by listening to all these different events. You know, each line, even in that first verse, like, he's pleased to meet you underneath the horse. And then the next line is, in the cathedral with the glass stained black. Well, those are different times, different events in his life. And they made it into his notebook. They made it into his world. And they belong together. He feels like they belong together. And in listening to the song and listening to it over and over, you're transported to not just one day, but to the scope of his whole feeling that he never made it. He never succeeded being a whole self, or, you know, his damage was too great. He says, "You're such a pinball. Yeah, you know, it's true." And that is me. I also feel like that. Like somehow I didn't have the agency personally to choose my fate, as much as I just responded to what happened. And decisions weren't made for me by other people. They were just made for me by coin tosses. So, but that's not, you know, I'm not listening to the song and like imagining Elliot Smith in that moment or what's going on with him. It's, he has done what he tried to do, which is get me to be in that song as if it belongs to me. Waltz number two. That's a song where he's telling a story. He's telling the story of his mother. And I can't be in that song as me. I can be in that song only as Elliot. And the parallels between his childhood and mine evoke my own childhood. But when I'm in that song, I'm over his shoulder. But in a lot of his songs, he's just evoking my world. That's the thing that I think is magic about his music and about the best non-narrative music.
Yeah, I think people find the little bits that they can relate to. And just like you mentioned, I think you explained that very well.
I mean, you little child, what makes you think you're tough when all the people you think you're above, they all know what's the matter? I mean, it's just like, I just am there as a kid with presumption and also feeling the humiliation of kind of knowing that described me and I see it now, but it described me and I knew it then. And he's not unconscious of conjuring that. Like, he has that vision. He has the sight to see that in himself and to describe that humiliation without self-consciousness. Because if you describe your humiliation then, now, like from a voice of someone reflecting, you're at one remove from it. It's not as hurtful because now you're an adult and you can look back at yourself as a child, as another person. But, you know, he's confronting the child and in an uncharitable way. And that's it. And there's embarrassment there that was present for him in real time, that I guess in myself as attempting to be a healthy person. At some point, I tried to erect a wall between the humiliation I felt as a kid and the self I was trying to become. And it's one of the things that I feel like he never accomplished as a human. That humiliation, that childhood, was always, he woke up with it every morning. It's just I lived with this record and loved it, and only later understood that a lot of what he was talking about was heroin. And that hurt my feelings, frankly, because I don't think heroin is a particularly interesting topic. Like, drug addiction is a thing I also lived through, and it absolutely is. It's why so many of us were so damaged, or it's a part of it. It's not why. It was the time we lived in the world of our parents that did the number on us, but we responded, some of us, by going into drugs in a way that at the time felt like a kind of almost a collective action. And then it became extremely personal. And of course, later you write about it, or then you write about it. In my case, I got sober when I was 26. So before this, I got sober like 3 years before this era. And it tarnished it for a time for me, because it was like, there was that whole heroin scene, that whole time, was really, there was something about the grossness of it that was indulgent. Like, we wallowed in it, lavished ourselves in it. And the way it was destroying our time and my community, it's sick to say, but there wasn't one of us that wasn't conscious of the glamour. I mean, the glamour ran out of it, drained out of it. And it was infuriating to me, especially being a few years sober at this point.
So did you come around at another point and then, you know, kind of reconcile with the song?
I had to come around on Elliot. And later times when I went to see him in concert, one time specifically at the Showbox, he was nodding off on stage. He sat on stage with a cigarette in his hand and went to sleep in front of a sold out crowd. And I was a practicing musician playing that same venue, trying to accomplish what he had accomplished, trying to make beautiful music, trying to sell out the Showbox. And it felt disrespectful, but I still listened to Either Or. It was still, I'm not somebody that has 600 records, you know. I have a small little collection that I go back to. And Either Or stayed in that small, inconstant rotation selection of records. You know, it was just a place that I felt refuge. You know, when XO came out, at least in my community, there was a feeling, now wait a minute, he's going electric all of a sudden? Like, he's the one that showed us the way. And now he's making a Beatles record. And of course, that, you know, he pursued that as he moving forward. But my relationship with him was extremely complicated. And I was on tour when he died. We played that night at Irving Plaza. It was Death Cab and Not a Surf in the Long Winters. And we're backstage before the show, and we find out that Elliot Smith has died. And we're all just, it was similar to when Kurt died. You don't know what to do. This was somebody that was sort of speaking for us, but we'd been hearing for a long time that he just wasn't functional anymore. And so, you know, we each kind of got up and tried to, like, Death Cab threw together a cover. We you couldn't not refer to it in the moment, in the time.
So I noticed that the Long Winters did a cover of Pictures of Me.
it feels like a century ago, and it was a long time ago. But that particular cover of Pictures of Me actually happened at a 10-year anniversary party for Barsuk Records. The thing about Elliott Smith is he's one of a few artists that you're kind of not allowed to cover, at least in my community. You play a lot of different covers. I mean, every one of us has played a Christina Aguilera cover at one point in our careers, but it was just so fun to do, to play this thing and to try and approximate the... I mean, one of the disciplines that he has as a songwriter is he often saves it to the end of the song. He's delivering something in the last few bars that makes it feel like it was, like you didn't even realize you were waiting for it. Like in Speed Trials, the last two times he runs that, the last line of the chorus, he switches to a major chord and it changes the melody. I mean, it's the same melody, but it's now bouncing off of this major chord that appears nowhere else in the song. And you realize, oh, how do you save a hook to the run out groove? And he does it over and over in his music, where it's just like, yeah, sorry, man, the bass doesn't come in until after the bridge. You're like, the what? How do you make a choice like that? But what it does is the song, you never feel like the last chorus is just running it one more time before the end. It hands you some in some ways, like some little small thing. Changing that chord is a tiny little thing. And Pictures of Me is kind of the same. Like it evolves so that the end is, the song like ramps up, and then the end is this total like drag, slow down, like, oh, everybody's dying just to get the disease. It's like triple heavy because the song kind of comes unraveled. So it was partly, I guess, when you do a cover like that, you learn to play it because you're trying to understand it better.
Would you say that Either Or is your favorite Elliott Smith album?
Yeah. Partly because of that punch, partly because I can hear the gears turning. I can hear how much he did with so little. And also I know that he was working within the same scene I was, and he knew, I mean, Heat Miser was a fucking rock band. Loud, obnoxious even sometimes. And this thing he was doing was something utterly else, and he knew it. And he didn't flinch. He never said, like, I mean, I think he definitely said, like, people are going to think this sucks, but it didn't stop him from making it. And I felt in myself that feeling of, like, I would start to work on something and I would go, oh, people are going to think this sucks, and I would quit. Or I would change what I was doing, because the idea of standing up on a stage and playing my own music and having people think it sucked was a real fear, a fear that has inhibited me as an artist.
Thank you then to John and to Elizabeth for that great interview. And when I was listening back to it, I really appreciated John's quite well-rounded view on Elliot and his music, and how that, although there were certain aspects he wasn't a fan of, that there is just so much there that he admires too. And as we've been talking about it so much, for our listener pick, we stick with the either-or theme. Here's musician Tom Lee from Leeds, here in the UK.
My favourite Elliot Smith song for the purpose of this is Say Yes. My favourite song changes weekly, if not daily. But I believe this song was the first ever song I ever heard from Elliot. It's definitely the first song I ever latched onto and fell in love with. And it's a song that made me want to dig deeper into his back catalogue and discover what album this was off either or. Going back to the song itself, I think it carries a lot of the attributes that a lot of Elliot's songs have, which makes me love it in terms of like the intricacies and depth of the songs. I feel like the more you listen to it, the more like layers you pull away, and the more you realize like everything's so like purposeful with his music, which I love, like lyrically and like sonically and like etc. But I also think like with this song, it's presented in a way where it seems so simple and so easy and accessible is a word. I definitely one of Elliot's most accessible songs, partly because it's the song that first grabbed me also. But that juxtaposition, it's sort of like the more you listen to it, the like in a way the more fresh it feels. Because you're sort of like every time you listen to it, you feel like you're discovering something new in the song, like you're in terms of like whether it be like something in the phrasing or the wordplay or like just a extra guitar line you didn't notice earlier, or sort of the way like the chord progressions like shape itself. With Say Yes, it's a really, really wonderfully like crafted.
Thanks very much to Tom for sending that in. And if you want to be featured on the show, then all you have to do is send us a voice note telling us what your favourite Elliot Smith song is to info@myfavouriteelliotsmithsong.com. And that's pretty much it for this episode. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time when our guest will be Sameer Gadia from the band Young the Giant. So I hope you can join us for that one. In the meantime, do follow us on social media if you can. We're on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. And if you're listening to us on Apple, leave us hopefully a 5-star rating or review too. Lastly, thank you very much to our guests today. Thank you to John Roderick and Tom Lee. Thank you to Elizabeth Wood Stanley for producing the show with me. And of course, thank you very much for listening to it. See you in a couple of weeks.